the only reason Netflix is deemed as being very successful at original content is because they, you know, it is literally throw as much against the wall as you possibly can. There is some.
Well, dude, you say throw as much against the wall as possible. I would describe it as a portfolio strategy. Yeah. But,
hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. We've got Jamie back this week and we're joined by special returning guest Ed Barton from Ovum. Ed, remind us what your job title is at Ovum.
My job title is a chief analyst for the consumer and entertainment team.
Consumer and entertainment. And as we're going to cover that, covers on-demand video and that sort of thing, which is quite a hot topic.
It covers pretty much anything to do with the digital consumer experience.
There we go. That's it. I knew you'd have the right shtick. So just to recap, we're going to be talking about sort of OTT video. We might talk about the broader sort of market and how that affects telecoms companies. Obviously, we've got people like AT&T have invested heavily in that. And then we might finish off, depending on how long Ed bangs on for, we might finish off with some chat about some of the lead news stories this week, which have concerned Ericsson to some degree, but we'll see. Okay. And just to remind you that if you are watching this on the site or on Facebook or on YouTube, you can listen to it on SoundCloud or iTunes or countless other podcasting platforms. Cool. All right, Ed. So we've written a few things. I think it's mainly been Jamie. We've been writing about things like Disney Plus, Apple Plus. There's a lot of pluses around. And HBO's Max, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's either Plus or Max or something like that. Anyway, these are all basically sort of big over the top, which is what OTT is.
Yeah.
Sort of subscription video on demand, SVOD platforms.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah.
Make sure I'm using the right vernacular for your patch.
You have the perfect acronym.
So they're these big SVOD platforms, and there's two interesting things about it for me.
Okay.
The core interest that we've generally had at telecoms.com in writing about this stuff is when telecoms companies like operators like AT&T get involved in it. So they obviously bought Time Warner, which included HBO. But the interesting thing for me, and then we've obviously written about things like Netflix, but largely from this OTT perspective, i.e. these are very data intensive services that go over the top of the telephone networks, but the operators don't get a piece of the action. So they've generally been viewed as quite sort of threatening and adversarial. But now we're getting to this new era where we've got a few other players getting really serious about competing with Netflix and I guess to some extent Amazon Prime and whoever else involved in this.
Absolutely.
In the form of Disney,
which
announced its move earlier on this year, but it's sort of formally sort of priced it and all that sort of thing.
And launching in November in the US and Canada.
There we go. And we got Apple, which people have been waiting for it to make its move for quite a while. Mm-hmm. I can remember way back actually, Ed, you and I, when we worked at Strategy Analytics, chatting about Apple and whether it could get involved in the content side of things.
Yeah.
So that's something that people like you and me have been mulling over for quite a while. Mm. And then we've got this HBO and we've got a few others. I think we've got Alliance with terrestrial broadcasters. Having said all that, I'll tee it up. Perhaps you could take it from the top.
Okay.
And I do invite you to talk about any research or writing you've done on it as well.
Okay.
Take it from the top and just give us like a snapshot of what the sort of global sort of streaming video markets like at the moment.
Okay, we could take up three podcasts.
I'm sure we could.
But look, let's try to keep it digestible and let's try to sort of think about, you know, how we sort of see these things relative to the broader development of the entertainment industry. You mentioned three huge launches which are coming up: Apple TV Plus, HBO Max, Disney Plus.
Yeah.
You know, we're pretty much of the opinion that this takes competition in the sort of paid OTT video segment to a new level.
Yeah.
I think Netflix and Amazon have been miles ahead for years, and this represents the latest, possibly the last attempt by some of the giants of traditional TV and video distribution to try to wrest back a little bit more influence, a little bit more market share over one of the main, you know, one of the few undoubted growth stories in TV and video distribution, which is OTT SVOD, subscription video on demand, as you mentioned earlier. Market share in OTT SVOD has accrued disproportionately to Amazon and Netflix and to the super giants, and obviously big organizations like Apple, like Disney, like HBO, like Warner Brothers, they want a bigger piece of the pie. So yep. This is the latest attempt. What does that look like? It looks like, okay, let's increase investment in original exclusive content, The belief being that this is what makes people sign up. Let's
differentiate,
absolutely, yeah. Let's focus our resources on fewer platforms or on a single platform like Netflix does. You know, whenever anyone mm-hmm. talks about Netflix's annual content investment, it's all going into one platform.
Yeah.
You count up the number of...
By platform, you mean for me as a consumer, I access it through one sort of portal.
Yeah. One OTT video platform, one branded platform. If you look at the number of OTT video platforms that Warner Brothers has, it's coming down now as they... As they close down platforms which haven't scaled, Drama Fever, Filmstruck, had very committed audiences, but were not putting up the kinds of numbers.
No, I hadn't heard of them. I've got to be honest.
So, of course, organizations like Apple, like Disney, like Warner Brothers, they can spend billions of dollars of content. So it's like, let's focus these in one weapon. And let's really try to build a single platform. We think that's this comes back to the philosophy that in OTT video distribution, scale is everything.
Yeah.
Having a scaled audience to having scaled revenues to make the sort of the size of content investment, which is just totally beyond all other platforms.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what famously, HBO spends on Game of Thrones, but Netflix does an increasing amount of original stuff. I certainly know I'm a big fan of comedy. They spend quite a lot of money getting comedians on.
Game of Thrones was a rare occasion.
Yeah, that was an outlier, but it's...
It was more of an outlier then than it is now. Think of things like The Queen and...
Westworld.
Grand Tour. Some of these.
They gave Jeremy Clarkson a bunch of cash, didn't they?
Jeremy Clarkson's not going to be shopping at Aldi for a long time. content spending, absolutely. This is one of the big things we look at. I think when we think about the levels of investment on content spending in 2020 for these key platforms, I think we're looking at about $10 billion for Netflix, $4 billion for Amazon, nearly $2 billion for HBO, about $1.1 billion for Apple, and about $1 billion for Disney.
Right, so Netflix is still outspending everyone by quite a long way.
But that is what I think spending is going to be on new original content.
Right.
Okay.
As opposed to just buying stuff that's already been made.
Exactly. Obviously, as a corporation, Disney and Time Warner, Warner Brothers, will be spending much more across all of their various outlets across TV and OTT. But that's how much we think.
Yeah, because Disney's obviously making movies.
Exactly. But there'll be much other content not included in that spending count, which will be added into those platforms, to the Star Wars movies.
So I've got one other question before I open the door to Jamie, who's been very patient. I suppose I'm thinking about, do you do OVM? Do you do studies into what a Western consumer, let's say me, for example, middle-aged bloke, couple of kids, on a journalist wage, no super yachts in my backyard.
Not yet,
What is the sort of maximum amount I'm likely to want to commit to SVOD of a given month? So right now, I've got Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I've got Netflix and I've got Now TV, which we got for Game of Thrones, and we just haven't got rid of it. So that's what we're talking about. £20, is it?
How much does Amazon average? Per month? Because it's you pay per year.
Is that 70 or 80 quid per year at the moment?
That's quite cheap.
£75. Yeah. So that's with the
quite
free.
Cheap.
So that's a fiver or something. Right. So let's say we're talking £20 a month that I'm shelling out on. Mm. SWOT. Obviously Amazon comes with all sorts of other things.
Okay. You're not typical for a start. So whenever anyone working here kind of goes, this is what me or my kids do, we just throw them out the window and give them a written warning straight away. you're a technology journalist, but essentially, look, there has been a lot of consumer research done on it. It seems at the moment the prevailing attitude is that I think U.S. households are averaging somewhere between 2 and 3 SVOD subscriptions per household. So obviously some of them are many more, and obviously some of them not at all. We sort of have a suspicion that perhaps this is going to top out at about 4.
Right.
Okay, four discrete subscriptions.
Do you think we can go that high?
Possibly, but then we also have to think about things like, the number of subscriptions you have, how much content does it give you access to? Because then we start looking at things like, so maybe for some subscription payments, you'd be paying for a service which aggregates multiple other services. So right. Something like Amazon Channels, where you can get access to things like ITV Play and a host of broadcaster paid OTT services through a single provider, a single bill. That kind of helps to sugar the, oh my goodness, how many subscriptions have I got? Do I really use all of these all of these things? We suspect it would probably top out maybe at about four. Okay. But then we also have the suspicion that during an economic downturn where there might be pressure on consumer spending, on household budgeting in general, you'll tend to discard what's not really fundamental to the household diet. So maybe you'll be like, well, I've got three or four SVOD subscriptions, but actually, you know, we need to worry about gas bills, etc. Yeah.
I'll drop Now TV. So, there's no more Game of Thrones.
Exactly. So so this is where perhaps the lesser used entertainment sources in your household will get will get dropped.
So, Jamie, how many things do you subscribe to?
At the moment, just one. But
Netflix.
Now TV.
Netflix. Okay.
But you know, other people in the house do have Now TV. But I mean, Netflix. Yeah. Right. I mean, I think the momentum moving forward, I think it's going to actually decline. I think the industry, the OTT and streaming and content industry on the whole. Mm. Is going to come up to a very, very rough patch over the next couple of years.
Right.
It'll still grow, don't get me wrong, but I think the boom years that Netflix has been sort of reaping the profits of over the last few years are coming to an end. And mainly because I think the value proposition is going to drop. I think, like you say, wallets won't be able to tolerate the number of services that are required to have this all-inclusive content diet, which we could become used to today, and the quality and depth of the service would decline. Mm. For instance, HBO is drawing back all of its content from the Netflix platform.
Yeah, this is a very good point.
Disney is clawing back all of its content from the Netflix platform.
It's much more siloed.
Very good
point. Yeah.
So there's going to be a huge amount of fragmentation.
Compartmentalization?
Fragmentation.
Yeah, without that, yeah.
The market's going to be massively
splitting up, isn't it?
Yeah. The market's going to be massively fragmented, but then at the same time, you weigh in the actual value proposition of each of these services.
Yep.
And I think that's where the original content is going to have to fill the hole.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
But I'm not as confident that original content can fill the hole because it's so hit and miss. Mm. It's so niche at times. Mm. It's not got the broad generic appeal that some of these titles have.
I think you'd raise a number of very good points. I mean, we totally agree that the level of competition is going to intensify enormously.
Yeah.
I think if your outlook, you know, which I largely share, is correct, this brings me on to another thing we're very interested in at the moment. You know, so we've got these super massive platforms launching. We also have, I think, in at least half a dozen countries around the world, the phenomenon of broadcasters coming together to create cooperative or OTT alliances, if you like, and instead of doing their own OTT platform, going, okay, let's get together with the other big broadcasters in the country, and let's do a combined platform. And so, you know, these are all launching into a similar environment.
And they have to distinguish them from their free catch-up.
Yes, absolutely.
So is that more an archivey thing?
So we can get very nerdy and lose people. Oh, so
you know
the concept of release windows.
Yeah.
So basically,
like when something becomes commercially available.
So let's take BritBox, because I think that that illustrates this problem nicely. So BritBox is the joint venture between ITV and the BBC. Will be launching in November or December of this year. It's going to be a subscription-based platform, and it will have a big catalogue of combined BBC and ITV content. So. I've kind of lost my thread a little bit. Sorry.
So I was talking about the
Windows. Windows. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking about Windows. So basically, how it works at the moment is something is shown on TV, Yeah, and for 7 days after, there is a catch-up window during which that content is available for free on BBC iPlayer or
Well, I thought it was more.
Well, that's the point. Ofcom have recently extended that to 12 months. Yeah, and so BritBox.
Well, they're obliged, or they can.
BBC wanted a longer catch-up window, so they say we want these programs to stay on iPlayer for longer. We want to enable more binge viewing on iPlayer, so we can put the entire series on there rather than
from 7 days to 12 months.
So the point about that is that BritBox is going to occupy the window just after the catch-up window, which was 7 days, but is now 12 months. So there is some discussion. It is like, is there still going to be the appeal, the demand for, you know, content which has been in a catch-up service for 12 months and then it goes on to BritBox?
And if they take that off Netflix, like I know my kids like to watch a lot of UK comedy.
Yeah.
And a lot of that they access on Netflix.
Yeah.
Like Little Britain or something like that.
Yeah.
Presumably, you know, back to what Jamie was just saying about how you can only get Disney stuff on the Disney thing and so on.
Mm.
Presumably, these terrestrial guys are going to take their stuff. I'm not going to be able to get Blackadder or Little Britain or Red Dwarf or whatever on Netflix.
Netflix is going to be a completely different proposition, I reckon, in about 18 to 24 months.
Shouldn't that mean that the Netflix monthly bill stay the same for much longer now because they won't be spending those hundreds of millions on the Office?
Well, so they shifted spending from acquiring content from third parties for catalog content, for older content, to investing in their own original exclusive productions.
So like 100 million that was for Friends, that's going to one.
Yeah,
that's
so they're like, let's use that to make new shows. But that's been a big shift. You know, Netflix, you go back to when Netflix started distributing online and pretty much their entire catalog was acquired from third parties.
And
over the years, they've been shifting their spending more and more and more to their own shows, which means, of course, that they own all of the rights. It's exclusive on their platform, and so more and more of their catalog,
anticipating what's happening now.
Exactly.
The one advantage they have there is that they've been able to foster talent from way longer and do all these relationships where, especially Apple, Disney was a studio, obviously, is a studio. Apple now is like, okay, who wants to come?
Apple hired two very talented executives from Sony, the movie studio, to helm it up for them. So, I mean, you're right. It's not like if we decided to start up an SVOD service, I would fly to LA and start being like knocking on Warner Brothers' door.
Because
obviously, you need relationships.
I mean, I'm not entirely convinced by the original content thing. Right. Anyway, to be perfectly honest, I think you can't build. It's a completely different business model. This isn't Netflix. Mm. And anyone who thinks that the growth years that they've experienced over the last 5 to 6, 7, 8, 9 years, however long Netflix has been around, is, I think, going to come into a very, very big shock.
Yeah.
Because original content just does not have the same appeal as your traditional shows on Netflix. Let's think, for instance. I can't think of any off the top of my head now.
Stranger Things?
A really popular...
Yeah, Netflix original.
The US Office. Oh, House of Cards.
Netflix original.
House of Cards.
Stranger Things.
Orange
and New Black. Yeah. That's a good one.
House of Cards was Netflix. Yeah.
That polarizes opinion. Okay. A lot of people like it and a lot of people don't like it. 13 Reasons Why polarizes opinion.
Which one?
13 Reasons Why. You're not a teenage girl, so you might not have heard of it.
Right.
But it polarizes opinion, and when they sold their catalog of Friends, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, there's very wide generic appeal to a lot of different audiences, and I just think it fundamentally shifts the Netflix appeal and business model, and I think the whole segment is going to have a massive shake-up over the next couple of years.
I've got one question. I just got one question about that. In terms of if we extrapolate what we've just discussed and assume that everyone becomes the guardian of their own original content and there's very little cross-pollination, then we've got certain brands like Disney. If you've got kids and you like superhero films, then Disney's probably a bit of a no-brainer.
Basically.
If you like really great high-value box sets, then HBO's a bit of a no-brainer. Sopranos, The Wire, Game of Thrones, that sort of thing. So the harder thing is these people who don't have a content brand like Apple or even like Netflix, although they're obviously working hard on it. Mm. You know, further to what Jamie say, to then go, you know, why do I go to Netflix for? I go to Disney for superheroes and cartoons. I go to HBO for The Sopranos. What do I go to Netflix for? What do I go to Apple for?
I think, you know, harking back to Jamie's point earlier, that, you know, that the era in which Netflix experienced dramatic growth, those conditions will never occur again.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, when Netflix was the only game in town for, you know, OTT premium distribution, all of the studios were feeding them all of their content. You know, there was no other competition. They were like, look, we're the only, if you want any benefit from this fast-growing market, sell your stuff to us. And all of the major studios, all of the big TV distributors around, all of the big broadcasters have enjoyed, you know, a reasonable amount of purely incremental revenue over the years, allowing Netflix to distribute their stuff.
Which is basically back to your window. Yeah. It's another window.
Exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. But now they're unwinding these rights, as you guys have been pointing out. You know, Disney have been taking back Star Wars. Friends is going to Warner
Star
Brothers.
Wars as well. Yeah.
Friends is going back to Warner Brothers. So look, so I think they were saying Friends, you know, would make Warner Brothers purely through that Netflix deal. It's hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Something like
It's still the most popular show on Netflix, isn't it?
Exactly. But
it's not very PC these days.
The interesting thing there is that, you know, now Warner Brothers are foregoing this at least $400 million a year, and they put it onto their own service. Is that going to generate $400 million?
It's a lot of wedge.
How long is it going to be before the subscriber base is large enough and the usage levels are high enough that an accountant within HBO Max can truly turn around and say, yeah, we got $400 million plus.
Far away, yeah.
But I don't know
about
you guys.
And so that's the dilemma. Do it yourself or be an arms dealer to someone else who has a bigger audience and can actually pay you more than you're doing it yourself.
What were you going to say, Pierre?
This is a difficult problem. Sorry, Pierre.
No, I don't know about you guys, but I rarely watch old stuff on Netflix, for example. I'm like, I'm aching to watch The Lion King from 1994 again. I mostly watch new things.
No. Well, you do. I mean, my kids watch all, like,
you're out of the comedy
box sets and stuff.
You cannot use yourself
like
as a sample.
I feel like the things I want to watch are the new stuff on Netflix.
No, if you actually have a look at them as popular programs through Netflix, you're looking at Friends.
No, besides those,
you're looking at
US Office.
You're looking at the US Office. You're looking at old stuff. That it's still a lot of binge watching nostalgia that's that people are engaging with, and that is Netflix.
Yeah, that is
Netflix, and it's a completely different problem.
I just don't think the original Disney stuff is going to be that great. Like, you know, they're going to
based on your personal viewing habits.
People are not raving about the new Star Wars. They're definitely not, especially the last one. Yeah, and then now they're banking on this new series, like
Mandalorian.
Yeah, what is that? I don't even know.
This is the problem with original content. It is so hit and miss.
It is.
I mean, how many times, like, the only reason Netflix is deemed as being very successful at original content is because they, you know, it is literally throw as much against the wall as you possibly can.
You say throw as much as possible. I would describe it as a portfolio strategy. Yeah.
but
essentially, look,
I'm sure yours is closer to their executives.
This is the same with any creative industry, music, games.
And a lot of people like crap.
You're going to have turkeys. You just got to make sure you got the odd hit to outweigh the turkeys.
It's
a portfolio. You're right.
Yeah,
you're not going to know. But what I would say is, okay, look, when we think about things like, so look, is someone like Disney good at creating new stuff? Then your own personal opinion isn't going to be a particularly good indicator for that. If we look at things like the box office performance of, say, the last 10, you know, Disney movies over the last couple of years, Disney has blown every other studio out the water.
Mm. Is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though Star Wars has been
well, but you think that, but obviously
no,
a lot of other
it's
people.
Empirical fact. I can prove it.
We're going to have to do is Star Wars.
But the box office revenues, they have gone down, though. The last one did less than the previous one, and I'm pretty sure this one will do less. It's the last one, so maybe it'll be still do good. But
I've got a question that's related to this, Ed. Is there any data on the bottom line effect of a hit piece of content?
Mm.
So, you know, obviously things like I always think of Sopranos as the definitive sort of modern day box set.
Okay.
Where they sort of rewrote the rules for really edgy, really high production value, really grown-up dialogue, all that sort of thing. Mm. And the buzz around it at the time was huge. And it's still, if you look at lists of the best ever sort of box sets, it was up there in the top five. What is there any data on the effect of coming out with the new Sopranos, the new Game of Thrones, what it has on the bottom line in terms of subscriber acquisition or something like that?
It depends exactly how you want to measure that. I mean, there are some interesting things that I think Amazon does in measuring the impact of its new original series, in that it puts a huge amount of stock in the metric of new signups who go to the video service, and then the first thing they watch is something like Grand Tour or something like another Amazon original. I can't remember exactly what they call it, but you know, that basically encapsulates this is what Amazon value from content creation. In terms of the impact of a great series on the bottom line, well, then, you know, then I think, you know, there are very talented strategists and accountants in Hollywood studios who do this all the time. I think, you know, what they would do is they would model the revenue impact of the distribution of that particular series in each of the respective windows in which they're selling it into.
Fair enough.
It'd be like live broadcast, then there'd be maybe international distribution sales, then there'd be how much can we make from the DVD box sets, how much can we make from the transactional downloads on Apple, how much can we make for licensing it to SVOD or whatever. And there are very sophisticated models to do all of that. Going back a few years, you know, if we take movies, which is where all of this sort of the concept of modeling that returns throughout the windowing system started. Basically, you can get a very, very good guess regarding how much a movie will make on DVD, pay-per-view, pay TV, commercial broadcast from how well it did at the box office.
Yeah.
Which is why box
office performance it tends to cascade quite predictably.
Which we'll never know.
Reasonably predictably.
We'll never know for the new Scorsese movie because it's not going to be widely released.
Isn't it?
They couldn't reach an agreement with AMC.
Oh, right. Sorry.
So, and that's kind of cool because this is the first time Netflix does $100+ million movie with a main director like Scorsese.
I didn't know about that.
And then it's only going to be released at like a few festivals and a few cinemas.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think the point I was leading up to that question is do we all agree that in this new sort of SVOD era, everything hinges on popularity of original content? Is it as simple as that?
But that's not new. The popularity of the BBC in the 90s was down to, you know, the new David Attenborough series, or what was it, Blue Planet drove ridiculous numbers of downloads and usage iPlayer when it was released when I was in uni.
Yeah.
I'm
not saying it's contentious.
I just think more than anything else, people aren't very good at doing original content anymore. If you actually have a look at the number of
remakes sequels
and sort of like biopics and that are in and sort of like movies that are based on true stories from the past, I think that there's a much higher percentage nowadays than there was before. I mean, I'm just plucking that off the top of my head.
But
the genuine original ideas like Star Wars in the 70s, you know, those genuinely really novel concepts. Not as many nowadays as there were as before.
Let's just sweat our Marvel assets as much as possible.
One subjective perception of how good things are compared to the good old days isn't particularly helpful in a commercial context.
No.
What I would say, so going back to Scott's point earlier, regarding, you know, is it originals which really drive the business? My suspicion is, again, empirical data is hard to come by on this, but originals get people to sign up. Catalogs make them stay.
Okay.
So you sign up for House of Cards and you stay to, and then you're like, ooh, the US
office
is there.
There's all this other long tail stuff.
I love this stuff. Oh, look, I'll use that. And then hopefully in a couple of months' time, there might be another Netflix original which will go, oh, wow, cool. I'll watch that instead of Parks and Recreation or whatever. Mm-hmm.
So that in turn might mean, and with all the caveats that we've all agreed on, that commercial, that creative stuff is hit and miss. But back to Jamie's throwing shit at the wall analogy, the more throw at the wall. Well, let me just quickly finish. I'm not taking a piss. I'm agreeing with you. The more throw at the wall, the more successes you're going to have. So does that in turn mean those companies who spend the most on original content are most likely to succeed? Is it as simple as that?
No, I think so, because let's be completely honest, who would have predicted that Stranger Things would have been, you know, one of the biggest series to come out in the last 10 years.
No one predicted Frozen. No one predicted 13 Frozen. Reasons Why. It's very difficult to predict.
But you just got to keep producing stuff.
That's a great example.
There's so many ideas that you know, I'm trying to think of some other ones that are terrible because I have watched some really bad stuff on Netflix recently. Some of their movies are really bad.
Well, if you're an Adam Sandler fan, then.
But, you know, that is. Everyone's chasing down the blockbuster, the next Breaking Bad.
People watch what you perceive as bad stuff as well. I mean,
they do. But that's not going to win you. It's not going to win you awards, and it's not going to win you permanent subscribers. So, for instance, like everyone forgets
gonna generate buzz.
That Netflix does bad stuff, but it only gets good stuff because it experiments with so many different ideas.
And spends money.
Look, I think, you know, you call it bad stuff. The other sort of observation I'd make is that, you know, Netflix is deliberately trying to appeal to an unbelievably broad global audience whose tastes are about as diverse in a single audience that you could ever hope to see. So, you know, they are. So obviously everyone thinks about Netflix's premium dramas, but they're getting much more into things like documentaries, into unscripted content. They're experimenting with game show formats. Netflix's ambitions is to replace pretty much all other visual entertainment distribution.
Yeah.
To do that, they have to be able to preach to a very, very broad church.
I think people will realize once they get Disney. Well, after you scroll through the first like four pages of Marvel stuff and Star Wars and stuff, you know, you'll get to the same as Netflix. You'll be like, oh my God, what is that stuff?
Get to that
all the obscure
they,
Disney stuff you didn't know about.
Spy yeah, dog or but something. On Disney, your kids will be able to watch Frozen over and over and over again.
Oh
without limitation.
Well, so that gets back to
kids are fans of Frozen, you probably already have the Blu-ray.
True.
It gets back to my point about the overarching brand of the S4. This sort of ties it all up, and I want to move it on a little bit because Jamie's short of time. If we accept that we're getting to a point where there's going to be a bunch of SVOD services available, all of which have got some excellent content, but we're unlikely to ever subscribe to all of them, then we've got a marketplace that then they need to be able to differentiate. And like we said, we know we've got a fairly good idea what the Disney proposition is. We've got a fairly good idea what the HBO proposition is. Now, one thing I'd say about Netflix, as well as their massive spend and, as you say, their desire to be all things to all people, they're also quite brave. Like, something I've been reading about quite a lot is a comedy special by a comedian called Dave Chappelle in the States, and that's rubbed quite a few people up the wrong way.
Okay.
And now I question whether Apple, for example, which I think is quite conservative and bordering on puritanical at times, ever allow this really edgy stuff. So then is the Apple brand going to be the sort of safe and solid? Yeah. And then how sustainable is that brand? So I guess that's what I'm wondering
about. I mean, I think from the look of the initial lineup of Apple TV Plus, their original programming investments, it looks like they're kind of staying away from kind of R-rated stuff.
Mm.
So it's, you know, stuff you're going to be okay with watching with your grandmother, the morning shows,
they got Oprah involved, perhaps
being slightly unfair. I'm not completely au fait with the detail of the shows, I would say that I wouldn't regard that particular type of brand value as necessarily a negative. I mean, Nintendo in video gaming for decades has been famous for a family-friendly approach, and you know they've done very well. Apple TV can coexist in a world where you have HBO doing pretty edgy stuff and Dave Chappelle, making some pretty edgy jokes.
They won't be making a violent gangster movie anytime
soon. No, exactly. Yeah. So I think Apple's going to end up bumping up against Disney most.
Yeah.
In that respect, in the sort of safe family side.
And then, you know who's laughing? The Jobs family.
Because they got a piece of both, haven't they?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. One thing I want to move on to on this topic is where it sort of overlaps with telecoms companies. Mm. And I guess the biggest one that springs to mind is AT&T. Jamie, we've discussed this before, but I'm still trying to work out whether AT&T buying Time Warner was a good move.
No.
You don't think it was?
No.
Why?
There it is.
It's just too bloody expensive. It's just too expensive.
Just getting that ROI is never going to happen.
Yeah, generating ROI is off, what was it, $120 billion by the time you factor in debt? I mean, that's an absurd amount of money to generate ROI. especially in a market which isn't going to be as profitable any moving forward, because securing these partnerships, securing new customers and customer acquisition is really difficult. You know, you look at it, we're probably in the US, you're at saturation point.
Yeah.
Are there new subscribers to gain at the moment? Mm. For every person that turns 18, rents their own home, you know, Dolly down the road is going to pop her clog, so you've lost the subscription there.
Dolly.
You know, I think you reach saturation points in the US, and this is why Netflix is pumping the accelerator massively hard in the international markets. Mm, mm. You're looking at the majority of their financial and subscriber growth at the moment is coming from international markets, where they're partnering with telcos to do sort of like carrier billing, new customers, a more direct link to these customers through a trusted brand.
Yeah.
HBO is an American business. It will have international interest, and it will gain subscribers internationally, but $120 billion on a US subscription service, that's a lot.
Well, then it comes down to that dreaded corporate M&A word, synergies. I don't think they just bought it because they fancied getting into the content and SVOD business. They're a distributor. They obviously have fixed line. They have mobile, and they see. And I'm not convinced by this vision, by the way. They see some kind of synergy between owning the content, distributing the content, billing it, advertising on it. They see all these synergies coming together. I'm still struggling. I don't know, Ed, if this is in your remit.
Yeah.
But I'm still struggling to see those synergies paying off.
Right. I mean, it's so, you know, look, talking about AT&T.
And you've got about 5 minutes.
Okay, right. Okay, fine. Look, it's AT&T, Time Warner. There's DirecTV in there as well. This is a massive, multifaceted beast. They have huge global ambitions, so I don't think it's just a US growth story. HBO content is reasonably, the HBO brand is reasonably recognizable in at least Anglophone parts of the world. Mm-hmm. You mentioned synergies. You also mentioned advertising and the importance of owning content and distribution. One of the things that AT&T, and this is an unproven hypothesis once again, but the idea being that, so AT&T own the relationships with pay TV through the set-top box, DirecTV, a number of OTT outlets, and obviously there's mobile TV and video distribution bundling to its cellular subscriber base.
Yep.
Yeah. And so what AT&T have done is they have established a unit called Xandr, X-A-N-D-R, which is its advanced advertising unit. And the concept there is they can say to big brand advertisers, we can track audiences across traditional TV, OTT, and mobile. We have various other bits of information through the set-top box, through the handset, depending on data regulations, you know, how much information can you get about an individual through the handset, you know, to add Indeed. Targeting experts with incredibly pointy heads and mind-blowingly scientific approach to this. You know, the data Cambridge you Analytica can get cough. From mobile is nuts. So the idea being is, look, we have all of these consumer touch points, we have all of these relationships, we can see what they're consuming across all of these different channels, we can give you a targeted advertising proposition for a single campaign buy across all three of these channels, targeted with elimination of duplication across the channels, more efficient, all of these kinds of things. It sounds great, but as I've said, you know, we're desperate to see some example of this. Examples of this strategy.
Quite. It looks great on PowerPoint.
It does. But you know, that would be one of the arguments that AT&T would make.
Firstly, with the advertising, I think if they can nail it, it's an excellent business. Mm. And secondly, on convergence, I am a massive believer in convergence, and I think it is an incredibly sound business strategy. But my issue with this acquisition and this sort of differentiation and sort of that shift into convergence is, firstly, I question whether culturally AT&T can continue will allow HBO to continue to thrive in the way it's done.
Yeah,
telcos are very, very traditional businesses, and how much of an impact will that have on the way Time Warner operates? Secondly, with Xander, I remember seeing that a couple of weeks ago. I question whether they had the talent internally to make it work, because the really smart people, although they will attract very smart people, the best brains in the business are going to be going to Google, Amazon, Facebook. You know, they're attractive companies to work for if you're an MIT graduate.
Indeed. And then finally, it's always a dilemma, isn't it?
And then finally, coming back to that point, I mean, I do genuinely believe in convergence. I think there's so many companies around the world that have managed to go into the multiplay and made it work. But 120 million, going back to that number, that is a lot of money.
Billion, sorry.
120 billion. That's a lot of money to try and claw back.
Yeah.
And I just question, I think logically, I understand the strategy and I think that it can be successful. But my only reservation is I think they overpaid.
Yeah.
Okay. I think clawing it back is just going to be... But the whole divergence and, you know, moving into new areas, the strategy, amazingly sound. I think it will be successful. But will it reclaw 120 million, a billion before they have to acquire someone else, before they have to spend on something else? All the original content they got to spend money on, the integration costs, the people they got to sack.
AT&T better have some pretty patient investors, hasn't it?
How much would have been acceptable for you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not an economist.
Less.
119. Yeah,
119 and a half. Ed, have you got any sort of final thoughts on this talk? Because I'm gonna just quickly finish off because I promised I would. Just chat about.
No. I mean, I think, you know, I think Jamie nailed it just then. The strategy sounds great, but there are some major execution challenges, and this is why you have very highly compensated people at the top of companies to make this work. So, you know, I'm sure if we're fortunate enough to have any AT&T or Time Warner execs listening to this, and hopefully they're thinking,
I think they base most of their strategy on this podcast.
Well, guys, watch this space. You know, we're coming. So, you know, fingers crossed.
Okay, so talking about executives who may or may not listen to podcasts, there's a forced segue there. I wrote a piece this week based on some speculation from a Swedish, the Swedish equivalent of the FT, I think. Okay. And their speculation was that Ericsson's CEO, Börje Ekholm, who's been around there for about 3 years, I think, and has done a pretty decent job of turning it around
in terms of
bottom line, might be due to step down. Obviously not because he's rubbish, but because, let's not forget, he was brought in. He's actually the CEO of a company called Investor AG.
Oh, they own a huge...
Yeah, they own a big chunk of it. And so he's kind of brought in by the investment firm to sort it out. You know, a bit like sometimes when you get sort of VCs sort of step in.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like that, but on a much larger scale. Okay. And so the thinking behind this, I stress that Ericsson has just said they don't comment on rumour and speculation, so that this is all just rumour and speculation.
Okay.
But the thinking is, he's done his bit. He's come in, he's steadied the ship, he's plotting in the right direction, but he's not the guy to be there for the next 10 years. To have the bigger, sort of more strategic look.
Sure.
And this article earmarked a chap who was the CEO of Saab, which most of us might know for cars, but has...
Fighter jets.
More recently, been fighter jets and aerospace and defence and that sort of thing. And he handed his notice a few weeks ago at Saab and said something about wanting to go on to new challenges. So people are like, I wonder what that new challenge could be. And it also just so happens that Investor AG, from which Börje Ekholm came and to which he may well go back, as well as being the largest single shareholder in Ericsson, is also the largest single shareholder in Saab.
Oh, how convenient.
So I wrote something flippant about them all.
There's a pattern here, guys.
Yeah. I wrote something flippant about them all having a big chat over pickled herring on the matter.
That's a stereotype.
Mushed salmon.
I know. I do it just to annoy / amuse our Swedish readers and listeners. So yeah, I just thought I'd say that because we're running out of time. Jamie's got to shoot off, but I said I'd talk about it, so there it is. Then we can justify that little caption, Pierre, on the bottom. But we'll have to leave it there. Thanks a lot, Ed. That was really interesting.
Great.
And we'll definitely next time something big happens, like Apple buys Disney or something, we'll get you in to chat about that.
Am I allowed to do a really quick
plug?
Yeah,
of course. Oh, yeah, so, please do.
I was just going to say that, you know, the big topics that we talked about today on the video side around the broadcaster alliances and around, you know, the step change in OTT competition. You know, we're about to publish a major report on the broadcaster alliances, which is going to include forecasts on about six of the key alliances in UK, Spain, France, Germany and Korea. You know, the launch of these three new platforms in HBO, Disney Plus, and Apple TV Plus is also generating a huge amount of new forecasting.
Okay.
Are going to form pretty key parts of various deliverables, looking at trends to watch in 2020 and another deliverable called the Road to 2023, where we unpack what's going to happen in the next 5 years. Road to 2024, I should say. 2020.
Okay. We've done that.
Thank you.
Everyone's
thank
bored
you.
Of training. That's yes, right. And
2023 is old news now.
And I'm sure that can all be accessed to some extent through the Open website at a very reasonable price.
We focus on value.
Value.
There
we are. Valuable content from Open. Okay, cool. That's absolutely fine. We can allow
thanks
that plug.
Much. Thanks very much.
Guys. All right. Thanks, Ed. And thank you for listening. And make sure you join us for the next one.